At the break, I was asked by our panelists to make a little bit of an announcement that I hadn't done, and it was a really good point. And that is, what, if any, are your affiliations and what was the other one?
Conflicts of interest.
Conflicts of interest. Thank you. So if you would, go ahead, Rob, and each of you go down the line and start. Say your name first.
So I'm Rob Lustig. The only conflict of interest is I wrote a book.
Okay. Nicole?
Nicole Avina. I am an assistant professor at Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. I've written two books and edited two books. I've also serve on the scientific advisory board for several different pharmaceutical companies and drug and food addiction treatment recovery centers. And I've taken consulting fees from various different organizations, including some in the food industry, such as the Sugar Association.
Ah, okay, thank you. Dr. Charman?
I have also written a book, and I'm not sure if this is considered a conflict of interest. I'm the medical director of a treatment program that is now hosting a food addiction program, but I'm receiving no funds from that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Appel?
Alyssa Appel, no conflicts of interest.
I have enormous conflicts of interest, but none of them pertaining for this.
So Eric Schlesinger, scientist at Oregon Research Institute. I am mostly funded by National Institute of Institutes of Health, but Dove has funded me, although it's for their beauty products, not the chocolate stuff. So that's as conflicted as I get.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we're going to, Alyssa, so let's start with you. Please explain the new data on opioids and food addiction.
So we know that there are several interrelated brain systems and neurochemicals involved in addiction, and it's hard to study those in people. So one of the low-hanging fruit, a place that we can look, is looking at the opioid system. And in addiction, there's no real easy biomarker of addiction, and that applies to food addiction too. So we struggle with measuring it once someone's developed a syndrome, and even that, we're going to talk about the complexity there diagnostically. But in terms of better understanding food addiction, it would be really helpful if we had a biomarker, and a biomarker of the level that the brain has food addiction. So that's kind of a holy grail, and we may never get there. But what we can do is look at opioid tone. And that's because there are ways that we can block opioids in the brain and temporarily look at that short-term withdrawal that people have. So if they have really weak opioid tone, and we give them, let's say 50 milligrams of a pill that blocks opioids, called naltrexone, then people, if they have weak tone, they get mild withdrawal symptoms very quickly. They might feel nauseous, have a headache. And the other thing that happens is when we block the opioid system, we've taken off the brake of the stress response system because the two are intertwined and interrelated, both anatomically and functionally. So what happens is that our stress hormones can shoot up. Within an hour after blocking it, you get a cortisol peak. So we've been trying to get a handle on that as a biomarker of hedonic eating. So we've been giving people naltrexone and looking at their withdrawal response, their nausea, and their cortisol response, and seeing, does that help us understand, does this person have food addiction, and do they do better or worse in treatment? So in one of our first studies on this by Jennifer Dobenmier, we looked at this was a small one, a small pilot study. We looked at these responses to naltrexone. So I'm going to call it an index of opioid tone, and how that mapped on to drive for eating, binge eating, and how they did in weight loss. And what we found was that the people who had lower opioid tone, so who responded more negatively and strongly to this pill, they tended to have greater drive to eat. And they also tended to do better in our small trial of mindful eating. And so we wanted to look at that in a bigger way. And Ashley Mason just published recently the study of what we found. And so in this larger sample, this time we had a control group. So we had just plain weight loss, and then we had weight loss with mindfulness training. And we found several things. Number one, this opioid tone marker, biomarker of what we think is Well, the question was, is this a measure of hedonic eating? So the answer was people who scored worse on it, who had more withdrawal, tended to score higher on food reward drive and food addiction. So it did seem like it was picking up some signal of greater food drive. And then we asked the question of, do people with this low opioid training do better in the self-regulation weight loss treatment? And what Ashley found were two important findings. The first was that people with low tone tended to have more dramatic reductions in food addiction, only in the mindfulness training. So it did predict an improvement in the food addiction syndrome. And then secondly, those people also tend to do better overall, although it was weak, so we're still working on refining this biomarker. But they tended to lose more weight and have less binge eating. Hopefully I got that right, Ashley. So we're interested in, can we find a biomarker so we can study it? We can look at how different foods have an impact on opioid tone without necessarily putting people under a magnet and looking at the brain activity. Of course, that's better. It's just harder and more expensive, and you can't do that with hundreds of people as easily. So that's where we're at, and we, you know, really would love to, collaborate with both animal and human researchers who are interested in this marker.
Thank you. Dr. Tarman, willpower versus biochemistry. How can we help people understand the difference, and why is it important?
Well, okay, so that's a big question in the whole addiction framework. You know, is alcoholism a choice, or is addiction a choice, or is it something that there's no choice? And similarly with food. As I said earlier, the analogy I really like to use is that willpower, we have willpower, and all of us have the will to pick this up or not. That's a voluntary movement. Where a person who is a food addict or an alcoholic does not have willpower is in the cravings that are induced, especially when it's rekindled, if they've introduced the drug into their brain and fired up that whole want. That, what is dopamine but the want? I want. So I've had a little bit, now I want. And you can choose to pick it up or not, but will you be able to stop that obsession? And that's the piece that, like I say, 20 minutes or so, EpiPen type of idea, to enough to call somebody to do some kind of mindfulness grounding technique. I mean, it's essentially a panic reaction. And if you can do something like that and remove the substance so that it's not continually firing that process, you might be okay. Again, because I'm working at the extreme end, I'm seeing people who are at the stage that, you know, Michael was talking about, life has become so unmanageable, they're willing to go into a treatment center for 3 weeks. So I'm not sure that willpower is even all that helpful at that stage. At a certain point when the addiction goes to a certain degree, we're talking about a primitive part of our brain that is far more powerful than willpower. So it's essentially like saying, if I've trained my brain either through a chemical process or a learning process that this will save my life, when the truck is coming, I grab for that first. And then I say, wait. And if that has been so fused, which is essentially what addiction is a fusing of that primal reward, primal instinctual, I've got to save my life. If that has been so joined together repetitively, neurochemically, however you want to look at it, then willpower is just, it's just a small little, it's very, it's, no, I'd say no, it's not enough.
Patty, do you mind if I follow up on that?
Yes, and you have the next question, so.
Okay, well, this is in my mind.
Yes.
One of the things that we do, you know, we do a lot of functional brain imaging, is we, you know, recruit a whole bunch of skinny, healthy weight kids and then scan them and then follow them over time and then rescan them after they've gained a lot of weight or stayed healthy weight. And one of the things that we're learning is, it's just totally incredible, is your willpower totally changes. Your motoric, like you have a premotor region of your brain that fires up when you're about to reach out and grab a donut. That muscle gets a lot stronger as you gain weight. So the more you overeat, the more you lose your willpower. You basically undermine your self-control. Your prefrontal inhibitory regions show atrophy. They get smaller. The reward regions get larger. The connections between reward and inhibitory regions change. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of changes. So the whole idea of willpower, once you've become a food addict and you sort of eat on a very habitual basis these unhealthy foods, you can't exert the same degree of willpower. And I think that's something to really understand. And it's the same thing exactly happens with drugs and alcohol.
Well, and that ties into this next question also for you, Dr. Stice. Why is it so hard to quit drug use and tying that into food addiction?
Right. So, I mean, what I think the field's learning collectively is that, A, you show that hyper-responsivity of reward and attention regions to the cues that make you crave and really desire the food or the drugs. That's profound. I think that's probably the key driver of this. Paired with the changes in inhibitory control regions, and you're basically you lose inhibitory control or you sort of get more impulsive with regard to whatever it is you're doing on a regular basis. But those two things, that there's so much about the plasticity of the way our brains change in response to habitually eating really energy-dense foods that we don't really understand. But certainly I think it's more of a function of if you walk a mile in those moccasins, it's going to be really hard to do anything else. It just becomes much more hard to kind of have effective inhibitory control, and you're just always thinking or craving or jonesing for the substances that are abused.
And
yes, Rob?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say that, you know, and I think this is particularly a problem when it comes to food, because this is what really dissociates food from drugs in terms of the level of exposure that we have to these different cues that are associated with that end up serving as secondary reinforcers. So you can't go anywhere these days without, you know, seeing a logo for Starbucks or, you know, your favorite fast food restaurant. And we're constantly bombarded with the cues and the smells and the sights of these different things. And whereas for drug addiction and alcohol, there's been legislation put in place to attenuate that. So we're not as bombarded with those cues and signals as, you know, we had been in the past, like in the 1950s.
And there are two very specific hormones that drive this phenomenon that Dr. Stice was talking about. One's testosterone and the other one's cortisol. And where do you get your testosterone from? Well, you know, adolescence. And where do you get your cortisol from? Facebook. Think about it.
Okay, Michael, from everything you know, could you name something, whether an aha moment or a treatment regimen, that helped you overcome your addiction? And is this somewhat a semantics issue? Should food addiction be called something other than food addiction?
Well, I was struck by the back half of that question. I hadn't heard before about RED, and so I'm interested in learning more about that. And what Rob was saying earlier, the skeptics who say, how can you be addicted to something you need to survive? So food addiction is, I think, a pretty bad name for it. I understand why it arose. I think a better name that would be really stupid and will never catch on would be some food addiction. Now, again, you know, it's because, you know, alcoholics still have to drink. They just have to make responsible choices about what they can drink and not be knocked off stride. And so there are things that I don't eat. I went over that earlier. And there are things that, and as long as I don't eat them, I'm far better off. It doesn't mean I'm now protected. I'm never going to have another addictive impulse. But I do know that when I put some substances into my body, I am far more likely to have a physical problem with it, the phenomenon of craving, which Vera mentioned earlier. So, you know, I think it is a bad name, but, you know, it is, you know, I said earlier, and it's really true for me, that I don't need to know that it's real to explain my experience. What I need to know is that I started acting in a different way at a pretty high level instead of just what was on my plate, and my life transformed. Now, so the question is how to entice people into doing these other things, and what did it for me was a suggestion that I was an addict. Once it was suggested that I was an addict, a whole new range of things opened up that could help me, that I never would have considered when it was just a question of, I just need to cut down a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So for me to say, well, it's not really important whether it exists or not, is true. But also, how do we get someone, like as I said earlier, I was in rehab for what turned out to be 9 weeks in 1991. Now, that was a different era in healthcare. That would be very unlikely to happen today. And I'm very fortunate that the timing was right for me to be able to do that. The insurance company paid most of it, and the treatment center waived pretty much the rest of it. And it helped transform my life. But who goes to rehab if they don't have something wrong with them? So this is the issue. How do we get people to look at it in a different way, especially in an obesogenic environment that we live in today? If half the people who, I don't know if I'm getting this right.
That's right.
If half the people who struggle with overweight score on the red scale, well, that's pretty much what,
yes,
but that's pretty much what Kessler said in his book. He said there were 70 million conditioned hypereaters in America. And the statistics say that there are 145 million American adults who are obese or overweight. So that's one out of every two of those people. And so, you know, and we live in a society where there is commercial incentive to add more and more sugar to the things that we eat. We eat, on average, in America, 22 teaspoons of sugar a day. There is no recommended daily allowance for how much we should eat, but the American Heart Association, which is certainly an old line, respected health organization with some credibility, says 6 teaspoons a day for women and 9 for men. And the average is 22. And I'll point out that I don't have any, so somebody here is eating 44.
Rob has a comment about that.
Michael, you're absolutely right. Back in 2000, it was 22. The newest data say we're at 19 and a half. Mm. That's actually on sugarscience.org, which is a website curated by UCSF, which both Alyssa and I belong to. It's 8,000 clinical research articles vetted by 12 scientists who don't take money from the industry and distilled into 5 messages for the general public. 19.5 here in America, 17 in Britain, and the rest of the UK a little bit lower. But the point is it's come down slightly, but here's the to Michael's point. If the American Heart Association says 6 for women and they're consuming 19.5, that means they're consuming more than triple the dose that's allowed. So what's the difference between going from quadruple to triple and a half? Nothing. And that's why we've seen nothing. We are so far over our threshold that, you know, this is, basically this is not going to change unless our sugar supply changes dramatically.
Okay. Were you done, Michael?
I can pause there.
Oh, okay. Okay. So these next questions, sort of, we're starting into the solutions aspect of all of this. So we'll start with you, Rob, Dr. Lustig, again. So what are the policy implications of the evidence from brain imaging studies on vulnerability factors for obesity?
So the first thing I want to tell you, and it's absolutely essential that you get this. Everyone thinks it's about obesity. It's not. Here's why. If you do a scattergram of all the countries in the world, obesity prevalence on the x-axis, diabetes prevalence on the y-axis, there's a correlation. But there are clearly countries that are obese without being diabetic, such as Iceland, Mongolia, Micronesia. And there are countries that are diabetic without being obese, such as India, Pakistan, and China. India and China have a 12% diabetes prevalence, and they're not fat. We are the fattest country in the world, and we only have a 9.3% prevalence of diabetes. How come they're more diabetic than we are if we're the fat ones? Problem number one. Problem number two, obesity is increasing at the rate of 1% per year worldwide, but diabetes is increasing at the rate of 4% per year worldwide. Right now, there are 422 million diabetics in the world. It's 8% of the world's population, and it's going up faster than obesity is. If diabetes are just a subset of the group of obese persons, then how would you explain that? Well, you can't, because it's not true. Lastly, everyone says that you get fat and you get sick. Well, it is true that 80% of the obese population in America is sick, with metabolically ill, with one of the diseases of metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, heart disease, cancer, dementia, one of those diseases. 80% of the obese population, and the obese population is 30% of the total population. However, what they don't tell you, and they can't explain, is that 40% of the normal weight population have the exact same metabolic diseases as the obese do. They get type 2 diabetes, they get hypertension, they get dyslipidemia, they get cardiovascular disease, they get cancer, they get dementia also. Now, they get it at a lower prevalence, I'm not arguing that, half as fast, but there are more of them. So when you actually do the math, there are all more sick people, thin sick people, than there are fat sick people. And when you add the total sick people together, it's more than half the U.S. population. And that is what's driving healthcare bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And the thin sick people look at the fat sick people and say, see, it was your fault. Garbage. But if thin people get sick too, how can it be about behavior? This actually looks like exposure. This looks like cholera or tuberculosis or influenza. It's just not an infection, but it is an environmental exposure. And the question is, what are thin people exposed to, just like fat people are, that can cause diabetes, hypertension, lipid problems, heart disease, cancer, and dementia unrelated to their calories? Answer, sugar. It's the only thing. And we have now proven, beyond a shadow of a doubt with our last study, that sugar causes metabolic dysfunction unrelated to its calories. Because we took 43 kids with metabolic syndrome, obesity plus at least one comorbidity, and for 10 days we changed their diet. We gave them the same amount of fat, we gave them the same amount of protein, and we gave them the same amount of total carbohydrate and calories that they had on their baseline home diet, but within the carbohydrate, we took the sugar out and we put starch in. We substituted starch for sugar. So we took the donuts out, we put the bagels in. We took the sweetened yogurt out, we put the baked potato chips in. We took the chicken teriyaki out, we put the turkey hot dogs in. Okay, so we didn't give them good food. Okay, we gave them crappy food. Okay, we gave them processed food. We gave them junk food. But it was no added sugar food. Every aspect of their metabolic health got better in the span of 10 days. And their liver fat went down by 22% in just 10 days on the same number of calories. And their change in metabolic health was predicted by the change in their liver fat, having nothing to do with their subcutaneous fat. So when we talk about people being obese, we're talking about their subcutaneous fat because that's what you see. We're talking about the fat you don't see, the fat in your liver. And that's what's specifically driven by sugar. And when you take it away, everyone gets better. So this notion that it's about obesity has to fall. Okay? I'm here very specifically to tell you all that we now have a new motto. Kill the calorie. Anybody from now on who ever says that it's about calories, I'm going to expose them for corporate malfeasance or malpractice, depending if they're part of the industry or part of the medical profession.
Yay. Okay. All right. Thank you, Rob.
So that's the first thing in terms of getting policy, because if it's about calories, there is no policy. Because then the food industry gets to say, well, any food can be part of a balanced diet. Eat less, exercise more. If you're fat, it's your fault. Why pick on our calories? Go pick on somebody else's calories. They hide behind this notion that a calorie is a calorie. Well, a calorie is not a calorie. And we have now proven it beyond a shadow of a doubt. And if a calorie is not a calorie, then we have to talk about which calories are the problem. And sugar calories are specifically the problem, unrelated to their calories, because sugar is like alcohol. Okay? Alcohol is not dangerous because it's got calories. Alcohol is not dangerous because it makes you gain weight. Alcohol is dangerous because it's alcohol. The biochemistry of the molecule makes it dangerous. Same thing with sugar. And after all, where do you get alcohol from? Fermentation of sugar. Mm-hmm. That's what wine is, right? We do it in Napa and Sonoma every day. The big difference between sugar and alcohol is that for alcohol, the yeast does the first step of metabolism called glycolysis. For sugar, we do our own first step. After that, they're exactly the same. Exactly. And they cause the same hedonic effects, they cause the same liver effects, and they cause the same market effects.
Right on.
That's what has to change. It's not about the calories. Kill the calorie.
It's a new motto. Yeah. Okay, Dr. Stice, is there a way to reverse the reward circuitry in our brain? Is there a way to override, if you will, our yes. brain's hyper-responsivity of reward?
Yeah, so I think to think about that, the answer to that question, the key problem with kind of food addiction in this light is excess valuation of energy-dense foods, and I'm not... I think there's, you know, high calorie, high sugar, high fat foods all play roles in different ways. But it's that excess valuation, and there's been three really exciting developments that have come out that have been shown using fMRI to reduce valuation of a stimuli. And this is going to get very wide ranging. So one is I'll state this. I think this is the most straightforward, is something called cognitive reappraisal. So as you stand there at Starbucks and look at all the pastries and say, okay, which scone do I want today? Which one looks the best? You're sitting there firing up your reward circuitry, your inhibitory circuitry is going down, and you crave the food, and you bite and eat it and gain weight and blah, blah, blah. So if you instead think about how eating that food will have this really long-term adverse medical effect on you, whether that's clogging your arteries up with lipids or, you know, making your butt fat or whatever it is, you turn down the reward circuitry. So cognitive reappraisal is a really great way. So next time you see something that's tempting, think of how it's going to affect you health-wise in the long-term basis. And somehow there's been beautiful work published in Science that just shows that that turns down the reward circuitry and hits the brakes. So your engine, you know, stops revving as much and your brakes go on. The second one, which is a little bit less bizarre, is something called cognitive dissonance. So we as human beings really strive to maintain consistency between what we say and what we do. So if I ask everybody in this room to tell me 10 costs of consuming sugary sweetened beverages, after you do that, you'll dislike sugar sweetened beverages because you've argued that perspective. And we want to align our attitudes to be compatible with what we're doing behaviorally. So anyway, we've been able to do that with brain imaging work. And again, if you argue against something, it causes your reward circuitry's response to that stimuli to go down. So you can basically talk yourself out of it. And it's really promising. We actually did a big weight loss study up in the military up in Washington, got a beautiful 37% reduction in excess body fat from basically having people say, why is it a bad idea to eat a really energy-dense diet and not to exercise enough and all that? And they just talk themselves out of it. It's just really cool. The third one, which is my favorite one right now, is something called response inhibition training. So you can basically create a computer program where I show you donuts and ice cream and cake and all that kind of stuff that we probably shouldn't be eating. And basically what happens is every time you see one of those things, I tell you there's lots of different programs to do this, I tell you not to respond. So you just inhibit an approach response, and then you go to all the other stimuli we show you, which I prefer to do, like fruits and vegetables, for example. And when we did that in a randomized clinical trial, we got a D effect size of 0.95, which is almost a standard deviation change in body fat, because we were sort of more into measuring body fat than BMI. But basically, you're training yourself to devalue the foods by inhibiting a response. So the more you don't reach out and grab it, the more your brain says, I don't value that anymore, and you're willing to pay less money, or you'd be willing to pay, the amount of money you'd be willing to pay for the unhealthy foods goes down, and the amount of money you would be willing to pay for the healthy foods goes up. But it's basically capitalized on the fact that we have motor circuitry input into our reward regions. And basically, the same thing that the more we reach for donuts and eat them, the more we like them and have less inhibitory control. This is the exact opposite side of it. So you can basically do computer training, requires no real people at all. You can log on the internet, do this computer training, and it produces weight loss that lasts for a long time because it changes how you value the unhealthy foods. And you could target sugary foods or whatever other kinds of foods you personally eat. But it's a really great tool, and you know, hopefully this will really take off. One of my collaborators in this work, Natalia Lawrence over in the UK, one of those tacky tabloids over there in Britain, had run a story on this, and they basically gave her $6,000 to set up a web page, and something like, you know, thousands and thousands of people have got on there and are doing this thing. I think she really focuses on training approach avoidance to chocolate in particular because it's a nice simple food category. But she gets great effects, and all you have to do is it's like playing a video game to make you not like the foods that you probably shouldn't eat very much of.
What's the name of this again?
It's response inhibition training. It's totally brand new. Harm Vaileen has done a lot of work in the Netherlands, Natalia Lawrence in the UK, and Eva Kemps uses attention retraining and applies this to food. That's not been shown to produce weight loss unless you mix it with the other ones. But, you know, we did a nice randomized trial compared to an inhibitory control training with the same amount of inhibitions and, you know, approach and inhibitions thing. So it's not like a general inhibitory control training. It's really changing how you value. It's reducing your overvaluation of unhealthy foods. So it's kind of cool.
The next question is for Dr. Avina, but if I may just kind of piggyback on something you said. Based on something that you just said recently, Rob, you mentioned you were testing body fat, but Rob mentioned maybe we should all be looking at liver fat more. So which one is it, or both? I mean, should you measure for these studies the body fat, or should we be looking at liver fat?
Well, I don't know how to measure liver fat, so I'll just stick with the body fat.
Not a good question.
There's subcutaneous fat. That's, you know, big butt fat, if you will, which is essentially metabolically, I don't want to use the word inert because that's not quite right, but it's metabolically less concerning. And it's the hardest to remove with any form of diet and exercise. Then there's visceral fat, big belly fat, which is metabolically active, which is basically what changes when you go on a diet or when you start exercising, you reduce your visceral fat. And then there's your liver fat. And your liver fat is very, very specifically driven by your diet and very specifically by the sugar in your diet, because sugar undergoes a process in the liver called de novo lipogenesis, new fat making. That's what we studied. That's what we studied in these kids. So we noticed in this study zero change in subcutaneous fat, and that was on purpose because we were trying to keep their weight constant. Because if they lost weight, people would say, well, of course they got better. They lost weight. So we're keeping their sub-Q fats the same. Their visceral fat went down 7%. Their liver fat went down 22%. And when we did a multivariate linear regression analysis against the metabolic health, the change in insulin sensitivity, turned out the change in the liver fat explained all the changes in the insulin sensitivity. The change in the visceral fat accomplished nothing. So we think it's the liver fat that matters, but that's the fat that's hardest to quantitate. And there are some lab tests you can do, but in general, that's sort of the thing you don't know. That's the thing you have to go to your doctor to find out. It's not something that's eminently available to you. So we think that the liver fat is the driver of this phenomenon.
Okay, thank you. And this next question to you, Dr. Avina, was also one of the questions from the audience, is actually more than one of them. So from a psychological standpoint, how can we treat food addiction? Is a 12-step program the best option, individual or group therapy? So what treatment options do you see as the most effective?
So, this is really an important question, because I think this is the question that is on everyone's mind is, okay, we all, I think, agree that there's a problem, and we're all learning about the different causes that are leading to this problem, but what can we do about it? How can we help people while we're figuring out all these details? And I don't have the answer. I think that I can say I'm a neuroscientist, so we do a lot of pharmacology work in my lab. So we've been looking at this problem in terms of treatment from a pharmacological standpoint, understanding that we know that overeating sugars can affect certain areas of the brain, and perhaps if we target those specific neurotransmitters in those specific brain regions, it can be effective at reducing our preference for certain types of foods that are high in sugar. So we've had some success, and again, this is preclinical, but we're working on the clinical studies now, giving in combination of baclofen and naltrexone, which are two FDA-approved drugs for other purposes. But when we give them in combination, we seem to see this unique effect in that it will selectively reduce the intake of sugar-rich foods, but it doesn't seem to have an effect on just total general calorie intake. And I personally think that is the direction we want to go. We don't need another appetite suppressant. The problem isn't that people are eating too much. The problem is that people are eating too much of the wrong thing. So from a pharmacological standpoint, I think that the goal is to try to target the system in a way that it'll allow us to reduce intake of the stuff that's bad for us. So that's one direction. In terms of the psychology of it, you know, Dr. Steis just talked about some really interesting behavioral interventions that could be promising, and perhaps Dr. Tarman wants to talk a little bit more about this from a treatment perspective.
The next question.
Yes, for sure, because
yes.
She's in the trenches working on that. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, it's going to be a lot of individual differences. We see this with drug abuse treatment. You know, not one prescription is going to work for every single person. So many times people who are addicted to drugs have to go through a variety of different treatment modalities before they find the one that works for them. And one thing I want to mention too, in terms of treatment, and that we don't often hear about when we think about addiction, is that, you know, when we typically think about drug addiction, we think of an abstinence approach where it has to be all or nothing. If you're an alcoholic, you can never drink alcohol again. I'm not so sure if that's going to be possible when it comes to food. Again, because we're talking about something that is so apparent in our society. We need some foods to live. And I like Michael's idea of calling it some food addiction, because in fact, it is some food addiction, not all foods. But again, we have to be realistic. And I think we may be thinking about more of a harm reduction approach. And a harm reduction approach, for those of you who are not familiar, and maybe Vera's going to argue against this in a minute, an approach in which one can eventually come to consume the substance in an appropriate amount. And again, whether or not that's possible for certain individuals who might have a more severe form of food addiction, that might be off the table for them, but there may be some individuals who would be more amenable to a treatment approach in that direction. So I think we need to keep our options open and be willing to investigate lots of different approaches, but I definitely think there's lots of people who are doing that work and interested in moving it forward.
Okay, well, thank you. The next question, I'll read it, but I already know what you're going to say, Dr. Tarman. Is there a solution for food addiction, medications, special diets, abstinence of certain foods? So you can just piggyback on everything Nicole just said.
Thank you. I've been really restraining myself. Thank you. Some food addiction, I think we could just say processed food addiction. And, you know, I'm a clinician. I'm not a politician. But the more I'm in this field, the more politicized I become. And that's why I'm so happy to have you on the panel, Dr. Lustig.
I don't mean to interrupt. The Institute for Responsible Nutrition is a nonprofit that we have set up. Wolfram Alderson is our executive director, sitting in the front row here. There's some literature on the table over there. So just know.
Yeah, so I think that ultimately this is a political issue, and I guess to some degree economic. You're absolutely right, Dr. Avina. There is a whole spectrum of treatment in addiction medicine, and there's a whole harm reduction piece in moderate drinking, moderate drug use, recreational. Can we curb that? And I work in a treatment center, and we're looking at the end stage where we don't see that possibility. These are people who have tried that. This is their third, fourth, fifth, sixth treatment center, and they've done the moderate drinking, and it didn't work. They've certainly done the diets, the various things. It hasn't worked. So, I mean, we're just looking at that. The pilot project that we're working on is actually, it is an abstinence-based model, and we have a food abstinent menu plan. So you might think, well, that means they're not eating food. They are eating the same amount of calories, about 2,000 calories a day, and it is all about choice. And the way that we've defined the food abstinence is it's no sugar, it's no flour, it's no grains, And then it becomes individualized depending on how far down the line. Some people can't eat dairy. Some people can't eat nuts. Some people can't eat seeds. But we start with that premise of no sugar, no flour, no grains. Because all of those things are, as you said, those are those four categories. They've been refined. They've been taken out. They've gone beyond our normal ability to our normal ecosystem of wants and inhibitions. So we have that program, and we suggest that that do the trick. And just we've been kind of giving it a 3-week trial. I think that at 8 or 9 or 10 week would be, oh my God, a luxury. But actually, the truth of the matter is that people usually, it's in the 5th or 6th day, they are already, we don't need a drug. The cravings are already reduced because they're no longer putting the substance in that fires up that desire, that want. They're like, oh my God, the cravings have been relieved. And that's one of the take-home messages that we've had in just the 5 or 6 months that this program has been going on, is that people on week 2, first of all, are saying, I can't believe I can eat this much. Wow, really? And not gain weight. They're not gaining weight, sustaining weight, or even losing weight. Some of them have gotten off of their insulin, by the way, in just the process of 2 weeks. So a lot of food, but mostly it's that noise in my head is quiet. I'm no longer obsessed. I'll just leave it at that. There's other take-home messages, which I hope I can get to later, but I want to just
go. If it matters, I mean, everything Dr. Tarman just said struck many, many bells with me. Let me just tell you the experience that we had in this kids study, which was really quite remarkable. So these kids were not taken off processed food. They were still on processed food. We gave them starch. We took the sugar away. We gave them starch. And they still felt this way. They said that the bell in their head had stopped ringing. In fact, the kids complained to us that we were trying to kill them with food because they couldn't keep up with the amount of calories that they had been on at baseline on the new diet, because a lot of it was solid food because we had taken a lot of the liquid energy away in the form of soda. And by day 6 or day 7, number one, the parents had noticed that the kids were actually more studious, they were less irritable. The teachers would remark at how much better they were studying. The kids themselves said they felt like their head wasn't in the clouds anymore. And this was still on processed food, just no sugar food. So I think we have a long way to go to determine how much of it is specifically sugar, you know, the crystals, the sucrose, the high fructose corn syrup, how much of it is polymerized carbohydrate, i.e. starch, you know, bread, rice, pasta, potatoes, you know, et cetera. And it may be that for certain people it's different ones, and we don't have the answer to that yet. And, you know, we're looking for the biomarkers that will tell us who's going to be responsive to what. But I would say if you're a food addicted and you get bells in your head, you can get those bells out in about 5 or 6 days if you want.
That's the message of hope right there.
Yes.
Yeah.
The next question is for Dr. Appel, but Michael, you had a comment.
I also was champing at the bit after, but I heard the urgency for Dr. Tarman, so I waited a moment. But, you know, to me, when we say from a psychological perspective, we're leaving out the question of biochemistry. You know, when I said earlier about the two guys going to a bar, it's not just, you know, food addiction as I experience it is not just a mind thing. It is a, you know, I put certain substances in my body and I react differently than other people do. So to say that it can be treated from a psychological perspective, I did hear Vera, I think, say that, you know, we have to go through different modalities until you find the one that works for you. You know, it's also very complicated because even though I'm a food addict, I am also a compulsive overeater. Now, compulsion is not a biochemical issue, as so far as I understand. I should point out, everybody up here is a doctor except me. The only letters after my name are BS, and you can make your own judgment about that. You know, then also I heard eating too much or eating too much of the wrong thing. Well, that's certainly true for me. But also, the first time I binged after I'd been in rehab in 1991, it was on lettuce. And it was just this I just was overcome by this. It was a little bit left, and the counseling, the training is to throw it out or compost it, not just eat it because it's a little bit left. And I just decided at that moment, I'm eating this. I don't care. And that was, and the other thing is that I am a volume addict. I was able to give up sugar when it was suggested. I wasn't able to give up flour, which I do think is, worth exploring. But I was able to give up sugar because as long as I could have volume. If I was going to Dunkin' Donuts at 12 o'clock at night after work and I couldn't get donuts, I could still get bagels. So I was still going to get what I wanted, bagels, of course, with fat on them. And then finally, the question of all or nothing. It is true, in my experience, I cannot get the same certainty that an alcoholic can get. Yes, no. A cocaine addict, yes, no. I cannot get that. But I can get a lot closer to it than many people would see. For example, I don't eat processed foods in which flour or sugar is above the fifth ingredient. So that's a very clear boundary. If it is, I don't have it. If it isn't, so that's all or nothing. Okay? And then the all or nothing around, as I said earlier, peanuts or popcorn or whatever but someone's problem foods are, that's all or nothing. So even though I will never get the same certainty, and part of me thinks, gee, I wish I could have that, there's a lot more certainty I can get. And when I'm trying to follow a food plan, the more specific it is, the more I can know, is this on it or is this not? And that's a question of all or nothing. Thank you.
Okay. Alyssa, this is, we had several, there's another one, of members in the audience that brought up the TV show, The Biggest Loser.
Oh, yes.
And, basically I'm trying to paraphrase the three of them, but, everybody ends up generally gaining the weight back. And what do you think about that? What about the slowing of the metabolism? So what are your thoughts, and whomever else wants to mm-hmm. jump in, but you begin with that particular show.
Right. I think we already knew that when you restrict calories, you slow your metabolism. And so that study of extreme weight loss found extreme slowing of metabolism and calorie preservation. So that's what we needed. We needed that kick in the butt to jolt us into this acknowledging that diets don't work. Mm-hmm. And I think that, most of us here, you're not going to see us promoting a caloric restriction diet, because it's about what you're eating and it's about the mixture, particularly the sugar, but the mixture of food, of fat, salt, sugar that makes it so palatable, and the caffeine. And so, when we train people in our weight loss program, it's about changing the relationship with food and training people to eat mindfully rather than caloric restriction. That's what we started off with. The truth is we did do a weight loss study because NIH demanded that we have, people reduce at least 500 calories a day. We tried to have them do it in, focusing on nutrition and not calorie counting the whole time, but calorie counting just to become aware of what you're eating and what the density of calories are. So the anti-dieting movement is going to flare up its head, and I welcome that.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, here's what happened. I can't believe that we have made it through 2 hours and 25 minutes without using the word leptin. Now, who in this audience doesn't know what leptin is? Okay, leptin is a hormone that goes from your fat cells to your brain and tells you you've had enough. Obese people have plenty of leptin, mm-hmm. but they're not seeing it. They have what we call leptin resistance. There's something blocking leptin signaling, because if their leptin worked right, they wouldn't be obese. I mean, it's just that simple. Either you're leptin deficient or you're leptin resistant. Leptin deficiency is 14 people in the whole world. Everyone else has leptin resistance. Mm-hmm. There's something blocking the signal. So you take somebody who's leptin resistant, i.e. obese, and you put them on a caloric deprivation diet, i.e. Biggest Loser. And what happens? They start losing weight, right? except that they are starving before any weight has been lost. And their leptin falls within 12 hours of caloric restriction, and they haven't lost any weight yet. So now they've got leptin deficiency on top of leptin resistance. So what do you think the brain's going to see? It's going to see starvation. So what happens when you're starved? Two things. Number one, your metabolism falls because your brain is telling your muscles to burn, and that actually goes down. It's called resting energy expenditure. It goes down by 20%. And the vagus nerve, which controls your appetite and your insulin release, is going to go hog wild because it's trying to drive what you eat back into fat cells to bring the leptin back up to where it thinks it belongs. So the recidivism of obesity is basically the manifestation of this biochemical process of leptin resistance that hasn't been fixed. So really, the holy grail of obesity management is, what's the cause of leptin resistance? There are probably several, but one that we absolutely know, and I have done the research to determine this, is insulin. Insulin blocks leptin signaling. The higher your insulin goes, the less well your brain sees its leptin, and there's a pathway in the brain to explain why that happens and how that happens. So when you get insulin down, then your brain can see its leptin. This is what we do in our clinic at UCSF every single day, how we take care of childhood obesity. We get the insulin down. I don't run a weight loss clinic. I run an insulin reduction clinic, and it works, and it works well. So the question is, how do you get insulin down? Because that's the holy grail. How do you get insulin down? Don't let it go up. Well, what makes it go up? Refined carbohydrate and sugar. Refined carbohydrate makes it be released. Sugar makes it resistant. You do the two together. Now you have massive hyperinsulinemia. Now you block your leptin signaling. Now you're fat and you're a recidivist. Fix it, and it all goes away. This is how we take care of patients at UCSF every single day. We are trying to develop this as a model for the rest of the country, and the CDC does not care. Does not care, because it's still just about calories.
Okay, so kill the calorie again. So, Dr. Stice, I'm going to ask you this one, and... but everybody can jump in. Does the gut microbiome play a role in food addiction or addiction?
Well, that's a good one. Does anybody have a better, a feel? I mean, I know the literature a bit that, basically your gut microbiome adapts to metabolize what you eat on a regular basis. So if you eat a whole bunch of meat, it changes compared to if you eat just vegetables or fruit. Mm-hmm. But I don't know the connection. I can't say that I have any expertise in connecting
it to food
addiction.
It was just an interesting question.
But somebody else might be smarter.
Well, there was the case of a fecal transplant where a woman who had no eating issues got a fecal transplant from someone who was overweight. Yes. I think it was an obese relative, and developed overnight this hyper food drive, and that experience that many obese people have was created instantly from her gut biota. So we do know there are signals there, and there is several studies on mental health and gut biota and how you can change depression with changing the gut biota. And now there are studies on food addiction. A group at UCLA, Emmer and Mayer.
Okay. This next question is going to be the last one that I'm going to ask a specific person. All the rest of them, I will let you kind of look at each other to decide who wants to answer it. But Dr. Avina, you mentioned hidden sugars in quite a bit of your work. Explain a little bit about what that means.
Yeah, so this kind of gets at the idea of the fact that, when we look at the different ingredients, and as Dr. Lustig said, all these items that are listed on the GRAS list, there's lots of different names for what we commonly think about as sugar. And so when you look at the nutrition facts label, which is on the back of all the products that we eat, you see that, sometimes there's the word high fructose corn syrup or sucrose, which are pretty generally recognized as sugars. But then sometimes there's things like agave nectar or fruit juice concentrate. And there's lots of other names for things that are actually just added sugar. And I think last time I looked, the list said there was about 55 different names for sugar, which is what we're talking about here, added sugar. So
my favorite's evaporated cane juice. Yeah.
Yes. And so you can notice that a lot of these, my favorite actually is agave, because people tend to hear these words and sometimes think, oh, well, this is a sounds healthier and more natural. Yeah. Often, I think the latest craze is now monk fruit sugar, which is some new sugar that people are using a lot of. Again, it's still sugar. And if you take it and refine it and put it into the stuff you're eating, it's going to add to the amount of added sugars that people are consuming. So I think that the sugars are hidden by the fact that they go by different names in the products that we eat. But I also think sugars are often hidden by the fact that we often will eat foods that we don't necessarily realize have added sugars. So, you know, it's kind of a fun game that I play with my geeky friends where we try to come up with the strangest thing where you can find added sugar where you wouldn't expect it. And so things like certain salamis can have added sugar. Bacon has added sugar. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just straight up bacon, it often has added sugar. And lots of different products that you think are a healthy food choice, like these different granola bars or, you know, health nutrition bars that have this nice marketing scheme where they're organic and all natural and, you know, the greatest thing you should eat, they often have lots and lots of sugar in them. So I think we need to be mindful about the places where sugar can be and really just be on the lookout for it all the time, because you never know where it's going to end up.
And this next question is sort of an adjunct to what you were just saying, Lisa, I believe it is. What about the testing of flavor, fragrance, and chemistry of processed foods to increase the desire for those foods? Who wants to take that one?
I'm not the expert on, you know, sort of food engineering. There are several books out, obviously Salt, Sugar, Fat I mentioned before. There's one called The Dorito Effect that also describes this as well. Ultimately, different foods are added to increase the salience of other foods, and that can increase consumption. They learned it in tobacco. That's what menthol did. Okay, menthol was added because a very specific segment of the population, primarily African Americans, found tobacco to be somewhat distasteful, but when they added menthol, it increased the salience, and so they were able to basically open up a new market. When you mix certain foods together, you can increase the salience. In fact, Dr. Stice did a beautiful study back in 2013 where he basically controlled the amount of fat and the amount of sugar in the milkshakes that these people, you know, sipped through a straw while they were in the MRI machine, to show that the areas that fat altered were the areas associated with the sensory experience of food, i.e. mouthfeel, whereas when they altered the amount of sugar within the food, it altered the reward center, the nucleus accumbens, which is where the dopamine is. So they were not affecting the same things. And please, Eric, I do not want to, you know, bastardize your study for you. It's your study. You should make everyone aware of exactly what you found.
Why don't you do that next, Dr. Stice, and then I think Dr. Tarman had a comment as well.
Yeah, it was just that we had actually all expected that there'd be an interaction between fat and sugar and how much it recruited reward circuitry. And, you know, sugar won hands down in terms of really firing up our reward circuitry. But, I mean, the other thing that's sort of interesting to note is that, you know, we have sugar receptors on our tongue. We don't, you know, the belief currently is we don't really have fat receptors on our tongue. It's a more of a mouthfeel, so maltodextrose will give you that feel, that sort of creamy kind of thing. But it's, the fact that we have inborn preferences for sugar but not fat that is observable in the first few weeks of life probably explains why there's so much sugar in all of our foods everywhere. But, I mean, I think the big thing was that in the 70s we declared fat evil and it caused heart attacks and we've replaced it with sugar. And it's unfortunate. It wasn't a great choice on our part. In fact, I would strongly recommend that people eat nuts, like just fantastic, you know, raw nuts, great source of complex omega fatty acids, and it'll make you eat less later in the day. I mean, you know, eating good food instead of eating bad food does seem like a good idea.
Well, it may make some people eat less.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Dr. Tarman?
Yeah, I wanted to actually go back to finishing up one of your questions that you had asked earlier, and it might kind of relate to what you're saying. In the addiction realm, the treatment program is 3 weeks or whatever it is, but that's only the first step. So putting down the food, putting down the drug is only the first step. After that, I think it's really important that that get mentioned for the small subset of the population who are actually addicted to food, that there needs to be something beyond that. And that's what we would call in the addiction paradigm, continuing care, aftercare, the 12-step model that you had alluded to in the community. It doesn't really matter what it is, but some sort of aftercare, because the person puts down their substance, the noise goes down, they go out into the world. It's everywhere. It's at Starbucks. And the voices will say, you know what? I'm good. I haven't had this for 3 months. Why don't I have a little bit more now? And there needs to be some buffer, some support so that that person doesn't relapse, because that's the recidivism that we see with these diets, like in The World's Biggest Loser, whatever it was. You know, they went on their phase, or any kind of a diabetic diet. They do really well in phase one, but then in phase two and phase three, when the food is reintroduced, because it's okay, we're not acknowledging food as a toxin, but as a food, then people, that's why they relapse. They go back again. So we need to have some sort of, that's why this is a political issue, ultimately. We need to have some sort of a buffer of resistance so that people are not going back and reintroducing this substance into their system.
There was quite a few questions here. I'll try to combine some of them about 12-step programs.
Can I just say a couple of to that?
Yeah, then, I don't know how to summarize all of them.
I just want to say that of the 12-step programs, there are food-related programs, and there's probably 7 or 8 of them.
Yeah,
the big ones are OA, Overeaters Anonymous. Mm-hmm. Then there's Food Addicts Anonymous. Then there's Food Addicts in Recovery Anonymous. Then there's another one called Grace Sheet Anonymous.
Yeah, they mentioned that one.
There's mm-hmm. a number of them, and what's the difference between them is essentially trying to ferret out the different. So like the Grace Sheet or Anonymous one is the no sugar, no flour, no grains. Food Addicts Anonymous is just no sugar, no flour. I guess you pick the one that works for you, but the ultimate thing is a number of them, OA does not, but anyway, a number of them suggest a food plan, and then they provide the support around that. So it doesn't really matter which one you find, but my suggestion is because until we have insurance coverage or we have some kind of continuing care follow-up, that's all you've got out there in the community to maintain this continuing care aftercare.
Okay. Well, I keep having questions. I'm going to try my best to pick out the ones that I think are going to want to be answered by the majority of you. There's a couple specific type of questions about different diets. Like they want to know, should I limit fruits? Mm. What do you think of the paleo diet?
Can I say something about fruit?
Yes, just, please.
Because that is a question that people often ask, because you hear, oh, sugar is bad for you, so let's avoid all sugars. I think that is a big misnomer, because I think that, and I think others on the panel will agree with me, that sugar from fruits is very, very different than sugar from Snickers bars. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if you have an apple, yes, it has sugar in it, in its naturally occurring form, and fructose and sucrose, but it also has fiber and also has other nutrients in it that are in balance. And it's in an appropriate amount that is very different than the types of products that we often see that have added sugar in them. So when people ask if I'm okay with fruit, or if I think people should eat fruit, yes, I think people should eat whole fruit that has the fiber. I don't think it's a good idea to necessarily drink fruit juice, because fruit juice is basically just the sugar extracted from the apples or whatever their fruit happens to be. And so you can have, 50 apples worth of sugar in, apple juice. So I think fruit is on the safe list, but I think it has to just be,
whole fruit.
Okay. There will be, by the way, for all of you, CBS News tonight, 11 o'clock, we'll be doing a whole thing on smoothies.
Oh, there you go. This is a great question.
And how they're not Eagles. Okay.
Yeah.
No,
yes.
Don't tell us about smoothies. Can I add, I wanted to talk about, Vera's point that there are a lot of political issues here. If we really want to think about helping the people with food addiction. We have to get it labeled. We have to fund the research. Yeah. And the very few who have the health insurance and are privileged enough to get into treatment and rehab will be helped because of this. But the other political issue is that we need to change the food environment.
Yes.
And that for everyone, we're having a health crisis. Mm-hmm. And so we need to start with what we can control. Where do you go to work every day? Where do your children go to school? You need, and we need, to bond together and start getting soda banned from our workplaces and our schools.
Yes, 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 yes.
And that's that UCSF, we have done just
we
that.
We are, yeah. Great. So let me tell you about the soda ban. We are in the middle of it. And UCSF gave us a little bit of money. Well, there was a tremendous effort from UC Wellness and from some of the faculty like Laura Schmidt to talk to the administration, who said, yes, we are a medical school and a campus that studies health. Why do people go into our hospital with diabetes and they have in front of them five different soda options? We are going to eliminate it. So every vendor on our campuses have agreed to stop selling sugar drinks. And right before the ban went into place, we got a few dollars to go in and survey thousands of employees and bring those in that we thought had food addiction, those who were drinking several sodas a day, for example, to really assess their level of food drive and take their blood and look at those liver enzymes. And I know this won't quite help us by the time this is aired, but we don't have money to follow up. We're ready to, in a month, we need to go in and do the post-assessment and see if it worked the right month so that we can get rid of the seasonal effects, and we don't have money. So if we could scrap together the dollars, if you know a philanthropist who wants to make this point that an institutional ban can change the health of the community, even those with food addiction, please let us know, Rob or I. Thanks.
Thank you. Mm. This is a great question. What about sugar substitutes? Awesome. Who wants to answer that one?
I'll take it. Okay. Everybody wants to know. Me too. I want to know too. The point is, we don't know. Why don't we know? They've been around forever. There's a reason we don't know. So actually, there's three reasons why this is a potential problem. I'll make it fast. Problem number one, there's something called pharmacokinetics. There's something called pharmacodynamics. They're not the same. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They're not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the FDA demands it. They do not demand the pharmacodynamics. It's not in their charter. So food industry goes, well, wait. Drugs, compounds marketed can't help our sales. This is complicated, takes thousands of people, long-term studies, can't help our sales. We're not going to do it. The NIH says food industry's compound, food industry's profit, we're not going to pay for it. So we got an FDA who doesn't ask for it, we got a food industry who won't do it, and we've got an NIH who won't pay for it. No data. Problem number two. You put something sweet on the tongue. Message goes, tongue to brain. Sugar bolus is coming. Brain to pancreas. Sugar bolus is coming. Get ready to release the insulin. But the sugar bolus never comes because it was a diet sweetener. Mm-hmm. What does the pancreas do? Looks like it still releases the insulin. Not as much, but it still releases a fair amount and way more than the calories. So that will still drive weight gain. And number three, there's now some early data out of Israel that says that those sugar substitutes affect the microbiome, change the microbiome in a negative way, and cause leaky gut and glucose intolerance. So it may be that diet sodas make diabetes by themselves, having nothing to do with their calories. Because it's not about the calories. And if anything makes the point better that it's not about the calories, diet sweeteners do. So we don't have enough data to say that they're bad outright. The way I look at diet sweeteners is the same way probably addiction specialists look at methadone. Mm-hmm. Okay? So heroin is bad, right? Why is heroin bad? Because it's got a short half-life. Clears your system really quick. So you get the big high, then you get the big crash, and then you want to go steal a car to get the big high again. Methadone is oral, so you don't have to inject it, and it keeps you at this level, okay? So you don't go out and steal cars. And the goal of addiction programs is supposed to be weaning you off your methadone over the course of 2 to 3 months. That's what they're supposed to do. That's not what they do. They just keep you there, okay, because it's working, and because that way they don't have to put any extra work into you. I think diet sweeteners should be looked at as methadone for sugar addiction. That is, it may be a way of coming off sugar, but the goal is to wean it down. The problem is we don't have any effective way to wean it down because we don't have Nicorette gum for diet sweeteners.
Okay. Patty, thank could you. I just follow
yes,
up on
please.
This?
Uh-huh. Dr. Stice?
So, I was going to say, I too would not put artificial sweeteners in my body personally, but there are a number of randomized trials that when you assign people to drink full sugar soda versus diet, you know, artificial sweetener soda, you lose lots of weight when you drink the diet soda. So if you do drink gallons of real soda, it's better to drink diet soda according to those randomized trials. And I think there's 3 or 4, but they all lined up pretty cleanly.
If you're consuming a lot of sugared soda to start with and you switch to diet soda, you lose weight. That is absolutely true. If you are baseline, in other words, naive patients who don't drink anything, and they're randomized to either sugared soda, diet soda, water, or milk. This was Mayersk et al., AJCN 2012. The sugared soda group, 1 liter a day for 6 months, the sugared soda group gained 8.5 kilos. The diet soda group gained 1.5 kilos. Now, that's a whole lot better, obviously. That's a 7 kilo difference. But why did the diet soda group gain 1.5 kilos? If it's zero calories, how come they gained anything?
And it's metabolic fat.
Okay, and it's metabolic fat. That's right, it was the visceral fat. So, yes, Eric, I agree with you that if you're a soda junkie, you know, switching to diet soda is clearly an improvement. But it's not like diet soda is a good thing for people to just go out and start doing.
There's okay. One thing I'd like to add to that. One of the experiences that I had is I used to be taking a lot of sugar, and then I did use for a while a lot of sugar substitute. But what I found is that, you know, when we eat 22 teaspoons of sugar a day on average, you know, we're really walking around shin deep in sugar syrup. And one of the, it has many effects, but one of these is it affects our palate. We really need a super duper dessert full of, you know, like mainlining sugar because we're used, you know, our baseline is way up here. And when I started taking that out of my body, my baseline went down, and now I get we are driven biochemically to have sweetness in our lives. I mean, sugar used to be nature's signal to us that something was safe to eat, and now the food industry has turned that on its head. But when I don't have this high baseline, I can experience the sweetness that comes from roasting turnips or something like that. I mean, if anybody would have ever told me that turnips were going to be my sweet treat 30 years ago, I would have not listened. So we one of the things about change is that when we experience change, then we've changed. And we can experience, you know, when we think, well, this is, you know, the 22 teaspoons is a baseline and that's how it is. Well, it's true. It's harder to experience the sweetness that is found in nature. But we have control over that. We just don't ever, so many of us don't choose to exercise that option.
Okay. Thanks. Now, there's two questions here that I'm going to combine because they're basically very similar. And that is, how do we navigate the real world surrounded by temptation? And this one, what about food addiction during the holidays and food-heavy events? So both of these are just like, help me, I'm out in the real world. What do I do?
Well, we are in the real world. There is no doubt about that. But it, just like I just said, we have choices. Just because something's really popular, just because something's on every corner, just because something tastes great, doesn't mean we have to eat it. It does not mean that. And I have experienced life for 30 years with ice cream sundaes and onion rings and all sorts of other things that I still to this day think taste good. And I during those times, I went through periods where I tried to go without them, and I would miss them. And I would think that that was the
zest of life, and how could I, you know, it's just so unfair, and everybody else gets to eat it, why don't I, and all of that. Now I've had 25 years where I haven't eaten those things. Remind you, I still think they taste good. But on the whole, having tried decades with that stuff in my life, and then decades without that stuff in my life, I am a, without a doubt, happier, more stable, more loving, more present person than I ever was before. Now, is that causal, you know, immaterial as far as I'm concerned? I am better off without eating those foods. I have made the choice not to eat them. I didn't make it quickly, I didn't make it happily, but I made it, and now I am much better off. And I think that if everybody in this room made the commitment to have no sugar or flour for 30 days, that about a third would not go back to it, not out of rectitude, but out of rank self-interest. Now, that's not a statistic, but I am certain I will never be proven wrong, because you would suggest to a group this size, how about giving up sugar and flour for 30 days? The reaction is, are you kidding me? I'd rather die. So we have choices. We just choose not to exercise them.
Okay. I also think Dr. Apple said this a few minutes ago. We also need to change the world. Mm-hmm. I think that we have to band together and make some changes, some serious changes in our food environment. Because we do have the choice, and there's a lot of personal responsibility associated with those choices. But when that flies in the face of an environment that pushes these things, and now in front of the fact that we have research showing that the brain is being conditioned to be wanting to consume these types of foods, I think that's a signal that the change has to come on multiple levels.
I could just come back on that just a little bit, I totally, totally down with that. We need, you know, it's like think globally, act locally, and it's the same kind of thing. We can't, in my opinion, we can't wait until the environment is changed, because there are very powerful forces that don't want it to change. And there are a lot of other forces that are not engaged in the fight because they think it's no big deal. So the biggest thing that I have at my disposal is looking at what works for me and then doing those things, going against the tide. And then we also need to work to change the system. But we can't wait for that to happen if we want to experience better vitality and better health in the long run, in my opinion.
If I can just say that, I think that that's why a conference like this or a panel like this is so, so important. You know, Michael, you get to voice a message of hope that actually you can live quite happily without sugar after 3 or 4 weeks of withdrawal. And, you know, on this very same panel, we have, the pre-clinicians who are substantiating that. And then all of us, it sounds like we've become highly politicized, which especially you. sorry. Even I am becoming more and more politicized because we do have to change the environment, and we have to fight that.
Right. And also, we have to acknowledge that the amount of control we have is extremely dependent on the family we were born into. And so at UCSF, for example, let me just tell you about our soda ban. When we looked at who was drinking soda, it wasn't the PhD and MD professors. It wasn't the graduate students. It was the service workers. And they were drinking about a liter a day. And so it depends, you know, they're going back to environments that are saturated and exposed. How can you ask them and tell them, you have control, you know, make the right choice? It's not about individuals going against the waves when the waves are as powerful as tidal waves.
Because it's subsidized and cheap. Mm-hmm. Okay? We subsidize this.
Yeah.
And we pay for it twice.
Yeah.
Right? We pay for the subsidy, and then we pay for the healthcare costs. Here's the problem. What would the world look like, or what would the food supply look like, if we got rid of all subsidies from all countries around the world? What would it look like? What would it look like? What would it look like? Turns out the Giannini Foundation over at UC Berkeley modeled this, did this exact, thought experiment based on the data. And it turns out nothing would change except one item, sugar. Down 33%, and that's what we want. The fact of the matter is, Washington makes this phenomenon happen. Mm-hmm. And Washington, unfortunately, is going to have to fix this phenomenon in order to fix the problem. Because It's about the subsidies. It's about the Farm Bill. It's about what we've been doing for the last 80 years and undoing it. Food industry has learned how to make money off of it. They don't want it to change. They've seen their profit margin rise as they've added more sugar to all of our food, as the fat has come out. This is their, you know, gravy train. This is their juggernaut. We have to fix it. We have no choice but to fix it. And everyone says, well, you're being the nanny state. No, I'm actually being the libertarian. Get rid of the subsidies, and we'll go a long way.
I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, what is the number one health problem in the country? And then it said FDA. Thought it was kind of funny, actually. But that's a segue to this question. She's a health educator for a large company, and they subscribe to traditional, I can't read some of her writing, but recommendations. How do you suggest that she proactively affect change without getting into political hot water? And on that note, whoever answers that, or many of you, like registered dietitians, have to follow government guidelines. So I'd like a
Well, the government guideline just changed. We now have a USDA upper limit for added sugar.
That's true.
The problem is the USDA still thinks it's about the empty calories, and so do the dietitians. We need all the health professions, the dentists, the doctors, and the dietitians, to move off calories, kill the calorie, get the entire health community to speak with one voice about what's wrong with the food. And then maybe, just maybe, somebody in Washington will actually listen.
I think we might get through all these questions. What are your thoughts? This is probably you, Vera. What are your thoughts on food addiction recovery programs? What's the best one out there?
You know, I wish I could say, give you a list and pick the best one. There aren't any. So, you know, that's the problem. That's the whole problem. We have a pilot project which has been funded by a donor who heard me speak about the issue and said, oh, there's the, you know, I got a bit of money. Would you like to fund something? And I said, yes, we need to have a program. There aren't any because it's not an acknowledged condition. Okay. But my personal particular bias is that until we have one to look towards the community, because the community's been dealing with this since the 60s, since basically the processed food industry's been stepping up. And primarily those are the 12-step programs. So if people don't like that, please get over it. you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There's not very much out there, and until we get other programs, it's support that we need.
Okay. Could I add to that? At fatboythinman.com/resources, there are listed some researchers, many of whom are on the panel. There are some treatment centers.
Yes,
there are some nutritionists
corrected.
Who understand food addiction.
Yes.
And I just want to be clear, nobody pays to be on that, and I don't get any kickbacks if people go there and hire somebody who's on the list. That's strictly, it's like when Ronald Reagan said, well, I endorse you. You know, I asked the permission of these people if I could put them on my site because I wanted to be able to serve as a resource. So that's fatboythinman.com/resources. And as long as I'm mentioning my book, I do have some copies with me today, and I'm happy to sign them for anyone who'd like one afterwards.
Yeah, I would just like to stand corrected that there are some programs. It's a handful. It's under 10. It's 5 to 10 in the States and one in Iceland. It's not very many, but there are some.
Okay. This is an interesting question. What about other chemicals in foods, hormones, antibiotics, pesticides? How do they affect or compound addiction? Do they?
10 words or less.
Yeah, that would be great. Then we can get through all of them.
Two words. No data.
All right. Okay, there we go. The New York Times recent article, why is there so much information about what does not work for food addicts compared with little news about what does? I think that we've already probably covered the majority of that question, right? Getting burned out with the quantity of info on weight loss and the conflicting information, is there one way of eating to make that you feel is the healthiest? And that backtracks to a question earlier that I don't think we answered about the paleo. So food plans.
Two words. Real food.
Yeah.
Michael Pollan.
Everyone on this panel, six people,
yes,
will absolutely tell you And I'm not putting any words in their mouth because they've already said it. Processed food's the problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Real food is low sugar, high fiber. Processed food is high sugar, low fiber. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Okay.
If you eat real food, doesn't matter what, you don't need to be on a diet. There's no diet that works because every diet regresses to the mean after 2 months. Okay. That's why everyone sees an initial effect and then recidivism. There is no diet that works. There's only real food. And when we ate real food, we didn't have this problem. And as soon as processed food entered our lives in 1965, that's when this problem started.
Eric, Dr. Stice?
I just wanted to remind everybody that, you know, when you vote with your dollar, when you purchase products, you are reinforcing industries or not reinforcing industries. So do it. Start now. Buy organic. Don't go to McDonald's. Don't buy soda. I mean, it's within our control to kind of reinforce that. And the only reasons why McDonald's and KFCs are all over the planet is because mm-hmm. people give them business.
That's true.
And we need to own that. Mm-hmm.
So, Dr. Lustig, this one is for specifically for you. It says, is becoming a fat burner rather than a sugar burner an answer? Oh, sorry. Answer in general, how to become a fat burner rather than a sugar burner. I'm not exactly positive with that.
The only way to become a fat burner is to take away the insulin. Because the insulin is what basically prevents lipolysis. You want to be a fat burner, you basically have to either go very low carb or ketogenic. Yes. The question is, does it make a difference? And the answer to that is the jury's still out.
Okay. Vera, you had a...
No, I was just going to say it's the ketogenic diet.
Okay.
That's where that question
And what
is.
Based on Lustig... I just can't read that. Right. Insulin moderation. Wouldn't insulin levels be the real biomarker for, oh my goodness. I should really ask people to print. Insulin moderation. Shouldn't it be the biomarker for health?
Well, we use that. In my clinic, we use fasting insulin as a biomarker for metabolic health, and we very specifically look at that and look at insulin resistance. What we've seen is that the higher your fasting insulin, the more you have to go sugar-free. Now, there is another phenomenon of pancreatic insulin hypersecretion, where you put out too much insulin for the amount of carbohydrate you take in, even if it's not, you know, sugar. And that is a vaguely mediated phenomenon, and then you have to go carb-free. So it's sugar-free or carb-free, depending on your insulin dynamics. But either way, it's real food.
This person wants to know why liver fat testing is not routinely done.
What was it?
Why don't doctors routinely check for liver fat?
Oh, they don't know what it is.
Okay, well, there you
go. It's a scan, you know, unless it's progressed, then you can tell with the liver enzymes. But you'd have to scan it, and we don't pay... That's a research measure.
Well, there's a blood test you can do. I mean, that doctors do routinely. It's called an ALT, alanine aminotransferase. Yeah. We get it on all of our patients. Here's the problem. When I entered medicine in 1976, the upper limit for ALT was 25. Mm. Today, the upper limit for ALT is 40. How come? Mm. How come over 40 years the ALT has moved from upper to 25 to upper of 40? Answer? Mm. Because everyone's got fatty liver now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they do it on the basis of, you know, large groups with standard deviations. Well, if the whole curve is shifted to the right, well, that's now where your upper limit is. So I've lived this. I've watched it from the last 40 years because I've been in this business long enough to have watched what happens. Bottom line, everyone's got fatty liver. 45% of Latinos, 33% of Caucasians, 24% of African Americans have fatty liver disease today, and their ALT is higher than it should be because of it. And so it has shifted the curve. So you go in to see your doctor, he does an ALT, it comes back 35, and he says, oh, you're fine, it's below 40.
Okay. All right, this one... since sugar is addictive and popular claim states it takes 21 days to break a bad habit, what are your thoughts on the whole 30 program? Maybe they mean 30-day program for the average person. How long?
I'll just say this, and then Vera can add her thoughts, too. You know, I think it's kind of tough to put a number on things. People always want to have a number and say, if I get to this point, then it's going to be fine, and, you know, I just got to get to this hurdle. And I think psychologically that's good for people because it gives you sort of an endpoint to look forward. But it's not going to be the same for everybody. Right. And so, yeah, if you can go sugar-free or extremely limit your sugar intake for 21 days, good for you, because that is a feat that not many people can do. And you're probably going to feel a lot different than you do right now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it might not be 21 days for everybody. Some people might need, you know, 60 days. Some people might need 40 days. Mm-hmm. There really is no one number that you can put that's going to work for everybody. It becomes a matter of self-experimentation, I think. And that's okay. One thing that I think a lot of people, you know, struggle with in terms of giving advice is we don't know the number. We don't know how long you have to be off it before it's going to, you know, not be a hold of you.
So the last thing, and I just kind of have decided to do this just now, so hopefully this is okay with our panelists here. In closing, basically, if you would each take maybe a minute or two to give the audience members your takeaway from today. Dr. Stice, what is something that people at home, what could you tell them? What's your takeaway? What can they do to help?
To me, I'm sort of newer to the whole study of obesity and kind of this area because I come from a different background. But to me, what most blows my mind is that there's, you know, like a dozen things that keep you, that maintain obesity once it's emerged. And it's a really good idea to never have, I mean, we should be preventing obesity. That should be our A number one focus. And, you know, we don't have very many good tools, but I think that's the most important thing as parents. You know, we should be really thinking about what we're feeding our kids and how we're, you know, what we're allowing into our schools, like sodas, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So prevention, I think, is a good idea.
That's great. Michael?
Yeah, I just heard the idea that most people couldn't do, you know, going without sugar. And I just want to say that that is a choice. I'm not saying anybody can do it without, you know, I'm the food addict, right? You know, what makes it different is that we can get support. We can work together. I heard that said a couple times. We need to band together. We're in an environment that's not, in many ways toxic to us. And we can find people who are trying to do what we're doing. And we can work together to help each other to do the things like wean the sugar from our diet, and I would say flour and other things too, but that's what I would say, is that, you know, working together in community, we can do an awful lot. We have done an awful lot. And so if you can't do it yourself, if you haven't been able to do it yourself so far, find some help and work together. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Apple?
Oh, I'm going to ditto what Michael just said. I really think strong, resilient communities are what we need to think of. We need to reconceptualize this problem as a toxic exposure in our environment and make it visible.
Yes.
And no, we can't fight it alone. It's not about willpower anymore. It's way beyond that. We're all suffering. And what we're focusing on today is the extreme 10% who develops flagrant addiction. We can use that to show the danger and that we can label it as a disease, but we're all suffering, every single one of us, from our toxic environment. So banding together and acting now with your communities, with your Facebook, with your institutions, let's not buy these, you know, support these businesses, and let's not let businesses that we are part of sell junk food and processed food.
Thank you. Dr. Tarman.
Oh, this is all music to my ears. As someone who works with individuals, I would say that the take-home message is that this is a condition that is devastating to a section of the population. It's not a joke. It's not something to laugh about. Ha ha, I'm a food addict. It is devastating. That's the first thing. The second is that there is a message of hope. We don't know about the trajectory, but clinical experiences, it's 4 or 5 days, it gets better instead of, it gets worse, and 4 or 5 days, it's a little better. Probably it does take 3 weeks to up to 3 months. That's the typical of any addictive substance. And finally, the third thing I want to say is that from the individual point of view, getting support, and even if that's political, because you're hanging out with people who agree with you, it's really important to get that social connection and support, especially in an obesogenic environment as conditions we're in, to maintain that what we I'm going to call aftercare.
Thank you. Dr. Avina.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Dr. Tarman just sort of alluded to, I think we have to take this seriously. Mm-hmm. And this isn't just about, you know, the small group of people who might meet the diagnostic criteria for having a bona fide food addiction, mm-hmm. when we look at the addiction criteria in that way, but mm-hmm. we're all at risk. Yes. We're all abusing food. Maybe we're not doing it every day, maybe not to the point where it's causing damage, but continuing down that path, it will. And this is especially an issue for our kids. Mm-hmm. You might have a skinny little kid at home who can, you know, eat ice cream and eat these sugary things, and you think, oh, it's okay, they don't have a weight problem. Mm-hmm. But they're now developing bad habits that are going to lead to a weight problem, and it's going to be very hard to change that when they get older. So we all need to take this seriously, to make those changes, and to educate, educate, educate.
Thank you. Dr. Lustig.
Three things. If food has a logo you've heard of, don't buy it. If the food has a health claim on the front of the package, it's the opposite. And finally, join responsiblefoods.org so that you can have your voice heard. Because alone, you are nothing. You are just expendable to the food industry, because somebody else will be coming along right behind you. But together, you actually can do something, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to band the medical profession, the healthcare professions, and also the nonprofits that care about this issue together so that we can speak with one voice. And we need your voice. ResponsibleFoods.org.
Okay. Well, many thanks for our incredible panel for their comments here today. We also thank our audiences as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.